It has actually been better part of a week since we, and part of this, the Yahwa blog, have continued our presentation of In the Garden. And so this will be the fourth episode of Yahwa's presentation of life in the Garden of Eden. The reason we have directed our attention to something that happened 6,000 years ago is because everything that is depicted in the garden is a harbinger of what we will soon enjoy. You see, God told us the story of what he thought was the ideal situation with humankind and how he worked with and engaged with Adam and then created Chawa for Adam's benefit early on in this protective enclosure of great joy. And the more we learn about it, of what was there, what was not there, Yahweh's instructions, how they were ultimately breached, why they were expelled from the garden, who convinced them that they should disregard Yahweh's instructions, what were the consequences of those choices, the importance of free will in the garden, why there were two trees, where the trees were, what each of those trees represent, what was the nature of the relationship between Adam and Chawa. And I do say Chawa because there was no Eve. It's just amazing that every Bible translation and every church and every place speaks of Adam and Eve. And Eve is the name of a pagan goddess, a Mother Earth goddess. And the text clearly says Chawa. Chawa does not, by the way, mean life giver, as many have suggested over the years. Chawa means to speak one's mind, to share what you are actually thinking, to make a declaration. So the more we come to understand who these people were, how God conceived them, what he intended for both him and them in this environment, the better we will understand what Yahwah is offering us. Because as we approach Yahwah's return on Yom Kippurim in year 6000, October 2nd, in 2033, it's just 5 days thereafter on the 7th of September, 7th of October in 2033, that Yahwah will be bringing us right back into the garden. He is transforming the entire earth, which at that time will have been a mess because, well, between man's pollution and religion and governance and militaries, the world will be aflame in war. And Yahweh is going to transform it into the perfect conditions enjoyed in Eden and then allow us to camp out with him there. So it's important that you know what Eden was like, what life was like, what things were there, what things were not there. Because, for example, if you're religious, you need to know you won't be invited back in, and you would hate it there because there is no one else who will be there who is religious. If you're overtly political, you're not going to be invited in, and you wouldn't like it there anyway because you'd find no one to share a political dialogue with. God is overtly opposed to religion and politics. So these are things to keep in mind, that the religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam have lied to the faithful, deceiving them into believing that if they're a really good believer, or in case of Islam, really good killer, that, or in the case of Judaism, a really good obeyer, in case of Christianity, a really good believer, you got to believe all of the toxic lies of that religion, that you're going to be able to live in heaven and all your relatives and everything else are already up there in heaven waiting for you. It's a complete and utter lie. And so truth matters, and I'm going to tell you the truth about what occurred in Eden so that you're aware of what God is offering, and you can make a decision. Do you want to be part of that, or would you prefer to go a different direction? For example, there's a lot of folks that think, well, you know, living in paradise is going to be sitting around on comfy pillows and eating bonbons all day. There's others that think, oh, you know, we're going to have angel wings. We're going to flutter around. We're going to praise God. And we're going to, who knows what else. bow and prayer. No. God hates the concept of being worshipped. Most certainly going to be worshipping God. He doesn't ask us ever to pray to him, and there was no prayer in Eden. He wants us to engage with him. And if you think you're going to be lounging around like it's going to be a celebration of the do-nothing day of the Jewish interpretation of the Shabbat, sorry. Not going to happen that way. In matter of fact, paradise is not about being idle. Adam had a job, a purpose, work, which needed to be done. And that's wonderful news, because lounging around for all eternity would not be my idea of a good time. I want to learn. I want to explore the universe, to be productive and useful, with something to shamar, closely examine, and carefully consider. I would delight in the opportunity to help accomplish something meaningful with God. And for this reason, you know, I'm particularly pleased to see abad, work, used in conjunction with Adam and the Gan Eden. As he has done for all of us, Yahweh provided Adam with some instructions, a little Torah teaching, if you will, so that he would know how to live his life most productively. And Yahweh, you'll notice it doesn't say and G-D, it doesn't say and the Lord. The text reads, and Yahweh Almighty provided directions concerning Adam, the man, saying, from every tree of the garden, you can continually and actually eat. A call. You can genuinely devour and consume consistently and enthusiastically being fed and nurtured. As it is with us, the Creator's prescriptions for living are contained in his word. Today, we should think of his Torah as our owner's manual. God's instructions for fruitful and productive lives, indeed, for great lives. Adam received the first edition. You'll also notice that this passage that Yahweh stated was not cried out from above. It was not from a distant heaven. Some aspect of him was near, even beside Adam, when he spoke and was concerned about him. See, Yahweh has several aspects of his nature that he has shared with us. One of them is that Yahweh primarily wants to be known by his one and only name, Yahweh. And he only has one name, no matter how many ways he manifests himself to us. There's just but one name. There's only one God, Yahweh. And he has a paternal and maternal nature. His primary way of interacting with us is paternal. He calls himself our father. He calls himself Dod's father. He is the father of the covenant. And while it isn't explicit, it is implied that his set-apart spirit, Ruach Kodesh, because Ruach is a feminine noun, would convey Yahweh's maternal aspects. And I've written all about this, probably the most vociferous chronicle of the feminine nature of Yahweh's spirit. But Yahweh's spirit is not a separate persona, as is presented in Christianity with the nature of the second person of a Trinity. God, there is no Trinity. It's a Babylonian concept. There's no mother of God. There's no queen of heaven. There's no Madonna and child. All of that stuff is utter religious nonsense. And the set-apart spirit is simply part of Yahweh. And he can set parts of himself spiritually apart to accomplish tasks that he wants done in our three-dimensional world. For example, his spirit came upon Dod when Dod was anointed. There are seven applications of Yahweh's spirit, seven aspects of Yahweh's spirit that were offered to me in this role as Choder. I don't think it's ever happened in human history, so I have a more significant application of the full breath of Yahweh's Ruach than probably anyone. And likewise, Yahweh has a nephesh soul. And the only purpose that Yahweh could have of a soul, which is a conveyor of his personality, of his attributes, of his inclination, of his nature. Like, we all have a soul, and our soul is the only part of us that has any value. Our Bashar bodies can be as Dodes was in his second life, sacrificed with absolutely no loss, because it is our nefesh souls that are transformed into spiritual entities so that we can explore the universe and be timeless and perfect with our God. But as it relates to our souls, something science knows nothing about, but it's the human consciousness, the ability to observe and then respond to our environment. All animals have it. It's what differentiates animals from plants. And like I said, science has no concept what it is, can't measure it, can't distinguish it, but they know that when it's gone, life is gone from that individual. The nefesh soul that Yahweh has enables him to project it into our world so that Yahweh could project his soul into a person, that he could matter, that he could enliven, very much like an avatar. He could project his nefesh soul into a form of light and in the midst of fire, in the midst of a column cloud. Yahweh is capable of projecting his nefesh soul so that he can do what he did with Abraham, for example. He dined with him. He can do what he did with Samuel, where he walked in his midst. So it is very possible for Yahweh to use this nefesh soul, a projection of his consciousness, and project it as he sees fit. And so that is likely what Yahweh was doing here. He was projecting his nefesh soul into a material construct that would have been in similar scale and style to Adam, so that they could communicate shoulder to shoulder, take walks together, enjoy a meal together, enjoy just the beauty of nature and other animal life and that sort of thing together. So that is what is likely happening in this particular circumstance. Now, Yahweh can project himself other ways. He has malach, which are spiritual implements. The story of Hasatan coming off the wall, him being actually a karub, which is one of the jobs, one of the distinctions, categories, if you will, of malach, spiritual messengers. They are a command and control regiment that follow Yahweh's orders. And they also have not only jobs, but Yahweh can project himself into our world doing these things. There's this terrible misunderstanding of what God can and cannot do. For example, in Christianity, where the impression is that God lived and walked among us, not possible. All of God won't fit into the entire universe, much less our galaxy, much less our solar system, much less our planet, much less in a single human form. It's just a tiny, tiny aspect of God's nature via either his ruach or his nefesh, both of which, by the way, are feminine, that can be projected in a person. And he has these spiritual implements, the malach, who protect those who work with him and who influence the world as it's necessary so that ultimately his objectives are achieved. The most effective way, of course, for Yahweh to interact with us is to convey the written word to us so that we can study it, get to know him, and respond to him based upon what we have learned. And that's what we're doing in this particular case. We're studying the Bereshith Genesis account that Yahweh shared. So Adam here had the first edition of Yahweh's Torah teaching. Now, you'll notice that Yahweh was therefore concerned about Adam and approached Adam on a very congenial basis. He did not try to intimidate him. He didn't say, "You eat from that wrong tree and I'm going to really whack you." Nah, it's just not that way. You don't see Adam cowering in fear. You don't see Yahweh booming a voice that, you know, shakes the fruit to the ground. It's not that at all. God's not pretentious. He wants us to be relaxed in his presence, to be comfortable approaching him. He knows who he is, and he is offering to lift us up rather than the other way around. So Yahweh was clearly concerned about Adam, and so he gave Adam fatherly advice. Now further, since Eden is a word picture of life in the covenant during Sukkah, it is encouraging to see such liberty and exuberance with regard to Yahweh's Eden instructions. They were expansive. They were not restrictive. There would have been hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of trees in the garden, and they were all available to Adam. There were no limitations on when to eat, how to eat, where to eat, or even what to eat. We say, well, you can't eat that other tree. No, he could eat from it. It's just there would be a consequence. So when it came to what to eat, at the very least, 99.9999% of the available options were acceptable. In fact, akal is the Hebrew word for eat. It is not only repeated, expanding its meaning, but was also spoken in the infinitive call imperfect. This collectively reveals that the relationship between God and Adam and the array of beneficial options was genuine, continual, unequivocal, expansive, actionable, and vividly depicted. Now, taking this to its natural conclusion, it is Yahweh's intent that we humans ought to be free to consume whatever we see fit, feeding upon all we desire. However, in the infinitive as a verbal noun, we will become whatever we choose to eat. Garbage in, garbage out, I suppose. If we consume Yahweh's words, we are nourished by them. We flourish and grow. If we devour man's political, religious, or conspiratorial rubbish, we will become garbage. Also interesting, English Bible translators want to render Shawa as if God was commanding Adam. But that would be like a general ordering a private to do whatever you want. But no, it's not a command when you say it like that, which is what Yahweh stated. When there is a million acceptable options, it can't be a command. Therefore, I certainly feel vindicated in being among the few who consistently translate Shawa as provide direction and instruction in an unequivocal and authoritative voice. In the realm of free will, in consideration of a language without a word for obey, and within the context of the guidance and teaching of the Torah, Shawa is accurately translated as provide instructions, guidance, and directions, as well as teaching for humankind. Freedom and liberty are good, but there is a point where they can be harmful. They cannot be completely unlimited, because the choice to restrict the freedom of others and constrain their liberty always turns out poorly. We call the result of a few imposing their will over the many civilization. And in these constructs, only one among thousands or millions has the freedom of speech or actions. We're seeing this today with progressives, which I call libertards, and their control of Europe and even many of them control over social media. They want to limit what you can say so that it either corresponds to their belief system or it isn't allowed. And this is going to become more and more pervasive as we move towards the time of Jacob's troubles. The distinction between total liberty and the consequence of irresponsibility, the influence of absolute freedom on ourselves and others, is one God has tried to explain throughout his Torah. For example, we are naturally fascinated by the sun, but too much exposure is carcinogenic. We ought not have the freedom to drive 100 miles an hour in a school zone. However, placing restrictions on our fellow man through religion and government for the enrichment of potentates is man's greatest abuse of power. Yahweh took responsibility for the first of us in Eden. Among an endless array of opportunities, there would be a lone restriction, some rails on freedom so that we didn't run amok. It was one God realized would fundamentally change his relationship with humankind, from him guiding us for our benefit inside of his protective enclosure to man setting the rules to our detriment in the world apart from God. The Rubicon between heavenly guidance and human dictatorships was placed at the confluence of the four rivers that flowed from Eden. God said, but from, and it could be but or and, then from the tree of the knowledge, ha-dea, the awareness, the acquisition of information through observation, along with the exercise of good judgment leading to understanding, the ability to make rational connections between appropriate aspects of discernible evidence, relationally, being moral, being discriminating, perceptive and judgmental, judicial, if you will. It is actually the feminine form of yada, and that means to know in a relational sense and to become aware of. Good, tob, which is beneficial and productive, correct and proper, favorable and enjoyable. And bad, that which is evil and harmful, corrupt, morally inappropriate, malignant, and disagreeable. Do not make a habit of continuing to eat from it. As a consequence, in a day, you will absolutely die, defined by having eaten from it. Barbara Sheath, Genesis 2:17. So, there would be an exception, as there must be when it comes to expressing one's freedom in relationship to others, this other being God. Adam was free to live within the home Yahweh had made for him on one condition. The lingering question then for the rest of us is, are we willing to accept the realization that Yahweh has established conditions, let's call them parameters, for living in his home as part of his covenant family? For your sake, I hope so, because there are five of them. They have been communicated as instructions for our well-being, and they are all in the interests of a loving and productive relationship. As it relates to these instructions, there is one prerequisite for living as Adam was doing in the Garden of Eden. The covenant's lone restriction is that we must not approach God with mankind's babble, confounding and interwoven political and religious notions. To be part of God's family, we must first walk away from the family of man. Now, that is something that I've had to deal with a lot here recently between incidences near and far. And what I've come to share and what I've come to realize is that there are very few human expressions of family that aren't shattered. Almost all of us, and maybe the answer is all of us, have an aspect of our family that is broken. Our mother and father fought with one another, or they were abusive towards us. Experienced both. We have issues with a sibling. We get married, and it just doesn't turn out the way we had hoped. I was married for 34 years, and, well, only 33 and a half of them were miserable. We can have the same issues of our children. We can pour our lives into them. We can give them every opportunity to grow and be successful. We can nurture them all the way to the point that, well, in my case, one of my kids, I think, had 15 years of college. Might have been more. And we can help every step of the way and fight every battle for them. But at some point, we must let them go. And sometimes it just doesn't work out. You know, I wasn't one who had issues with grandparents, because I only knew one, and she passed away when I was five. But I have had challenges with grandchildren, not because my grandchildren were bad. I got to know my first and only granddaughter, and it was the most special, loving, uplifting, just genuine, happy thing that I had experienced in a very long time. But even that was taken away because when I divorced my ex, my eldest son was imprinted by her, and he made certain to know that our relationship would be fractured as a result. It's just the nature of things. Adam and Chawa had a fractured relationship, and their children had a really, really fractured relationship, with one killing another. And they were expelled from the garden, and there were consequences as a result. Look at the relationship between Abraham and Sarah. Abraham pimped Sarah out twice, you know, for lambs. I mean, what a disgusting thing to do. He chose Ishak, who became the forefather of Islam, over Ishmael over Ishak, which, you know, Yahweh chose Ishak. He was born of Sarah. His name means laughter. He was the first child of the covenant. And that's who Yahweh chose, but not Abraham. Abraham wanted Ishmael, became the father of Islam. So that was a mess. And you know, you go forward in time and look at Moshe. I mean, one of the most enlightening, turns out to be prophetic, episodes in Moshe's life is when his sister and his brother turned on him. Now, his brother had made a career of being stupid. I mean, Aaron was one really bad dude. As Yahweh said, the only reason that Aaron would accompany them and Moshe is that Aaron had the gift of gab. He could talk about anything, but that doesn't mean that the brain was ever engaged. I mean, we get right out of Mitzrayim, and the first thing Aaron does is orchestrate the manufacture of a golden calf. Well, Aaron, who wasn't the spokesperson in this thing, was approached Moshe and said, you know, you're not going to be the only one that speaks for God. We speak for him too. Yeah, God doesn't do that. God says, you know, Moshe, I'm speaking through you. He even came down from Mount Horeb to tell all Yisrael, this is my guy. I am speaking through him. You know, the same thing is true with the Yahweh's prophets. The same thing is true even of the role that I'm playing on your behalf today. But, you know, there are lots of people that want to claim that they speak for God. And in this case, Miriam did, prophetic of exactly what we're experiencing in a different situation with a fractured family relationship today. And Yahweh had absolutely no part of it. But nonetheless, Moshe, the first of the Zeruah, had an exceedingly fractured family. Then we move to Dod. You can't have a more messed up family than Dod. I mean, his firstborn son raped his daughter. His third son, Absalom, killed his firstborn son. Then Absalom leads a coup against him. I mean, he made the tragic mistake of sending a really good man off to fight a battle that he thought he would get killed at, so that when he was killed, he could steal his wife. Dod's my king. He is my guy. I love him. But like all of us, Dod had some real aches and pains and flaws and his life along the way. It is, by the way, those things which build character. I mean, we have to fail and then get back up and realize that we have failed before we have a backbone, before we have any courage or boldness. And in the case of Dod, he pined all over the death of Absalom, even though Absalom left a coup against him. And he had to have someone look him in the eye and say, stop it. Don't do that. So it is the history of humankind, fractured families. And so what Yahweh is doing is he isn't trying to fix the human family. He is telling you the human family is badly broken, but it at its very best, it is designed to reflect the covenant family that he is offering to us, which is perfect. So this is the message. To enter Yahweh's covenant family, we must disassociate from the fractured and really hurtful things that occur in the family of man. It was the tree of truth and lies, of right and wrong, commingled together in this particular tree. It is the way to the covenant and the religious myths which preclude participation with limbs intertwined in this regard. Nothing is as empowering, nothing is as beguiling. I mean, I think to a very large degree, the role that Yahweh has asked me to fulfill, because the first designation that we came across in this particular role is Choter. The 11th chapter of Yahshua 11 is written specifically of who the Choter is and how he's going to be empowered to fulfill this mission, and what he is going to write and then convey that calls God's people home. And the Choter is a stem off the main branch. It is a sucker that gives life to the fallen stump or rootstock that is Israel. And so there is a significant inference that though David is the main branch off of the tree of lives, which enables us to have our lives restored as part of the covenant family for having fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim, and that my role is to be a source of knowledge, both that which is good and productive and that which is counter to your interests and therefore unproductive. And you have to know both. It is essential that you know that Islam declared war on God's people, which is why I wrote the 5 volumes of Goddamn Religion. It's important that you know that Christianity piled its lies right on top of the truth when they created the counterfeit of Dode. It's important that you know that Judaism countered the counterfeit Messiah with a counterfeit Messiah of their own, and Rabbi Akiva, the father of Rabbinic Judaism, foisted Bar Kokhba on the Jewish people, causing the diaspora and tragedy for God's people. It's important that you know those things so that you can clear away the muck and see Yahweh more clearly. And at the same time, once that muck has been cleared away in Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, even of progressive hypocrisy, then it is important for you to know the truth. And the way that you come to know the truth is through accurate translations of Yahweh's testimony combined with commentary and insights that bring it home to you in such a way that it is actionable, that you can understand who Yahweh is, what he is offering, and what he expects in return. So, quite frankly, nothing is more empowering or more beguiling than evidence, whether it is of things that are good or things that are bad. And if I may be so bold, the Torah and prophets serve as an exceptionally abundant source of knowledge, both of what is good and what is bad. Good is adept at commending the virtues of the covenant. And he is, in this case, God is condemning the religions of man. So we have commending the covenant, condemning religion. These books that I've compiled that are free at yadayah.com upon Yahweh's Torah teaching are similarly robust in explaining the achievements of Yahweh and Dode as they work together to fulfill and enable the Bereth covenant and the Mikre. But they are equally assailing of the counterfeits and perversions of God's message and achievements. In the covenant, after disassociating from the babel of man, we are invited to walk to Yahweh along the path of the Mikre, beginning at Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim. This is followed by an ingathering on Shavuah and Teruah, a great sacrifice by the Adam of Parah the following day, and then 10 days later, the great family reunion and homecoming on Kippurim, so that we can return to the garden on Sukkah. Along the way, we become immortal, perfected, adopted, empowered, and enriched. It's a wonderful deal. We give up nothing of value and we gain everything of value. So after coming to know what he was offering and expecting in return, we are asked to trust and rely upon Yahweh to do as he has promised, such that we are not trying to save ourselves individually, nationally, or religiously. We are therefore encouraged to closely examine and carefully consider these instructive terms and conditions of the relationship so that we can make an informed, rational, responsible, and valid decision. After all, trust is predicated upon knowledge. Those are the first four conditions of the covenant. Finally, the fifth condition, we are guided as parents to circumcise our sons in recognition that the doorway to life and the pathway to heaven provided through the mikre are restricted to those who bear the sign of the covenant. And that sign reveals that we have been cut into the covenant by severing ties with those who have been excluded. In the garden, however, there were no confounding human institutions to avoid and disassociate from, because it was already part, set apart from them, if you will, and distinct from politics and religion. There was none of those things there. No curmudgeons. By being placed in the garden, Adam had been removed from humanity's corruptive institutions. Adam was already perfect in God's eyes, and there was nothing to corrupt him, making the mikre premature. And as his creator, when it became his responsibility, Yahweh would have followed his own advice and circumcised the first man conceived in his image. Therefore, just as there were two aspects of this tree, Adam would have to acknowledge and respect God's conditions to remain an immortal guest in his home. He would have to contemplate Yahweh's terms and rely on God's judgment rather than his own. In a cosmic sense, in eternity, when we are empowered and become seven-dimensional with the universe at our beck and call, this would be like saying, you can visit and enjoy the 400 billion galaxies out there that I've provided for your entertainment, each averaging 100 billion stars or so, most replete with solar systems and those with a score of planets and moons. But do not venture into a black hole, because you will not be able to escape. Rather than a constraint on free will, it's advice which allows it to continue. The Hebrew word for a tree is etz. It is one that I've just recently begun to consider, because my king represents one of these trees, and as I shared with you, I likely represent the other. Serving as a metaphor, an etz is held steadfast by its roots and does not change location. Similar to the path Yahweh, path to God that Yahweh has provided through the mikre, it is established, and it does not change. As is the case with those who engage with Yah, a tree is upright. It's not bowed down. Its branches reaching out to receive the light. The most stalwart shamak branch of God's Etz Chamim, tree of lives, doe to David, will live three of them. He is already experienced the first two, and he provided the means to extend our lives by fulfilling the moed on behalf of the bereath. Also interesting, the inspired advice and counsel Dode is offering through the lyrics of his songs, the Mizmor, which we have been considering in our ode to Dode, the 89th Mizmor. They are all designed to help us develop a backbone and some character based upon evidence and reason. When we are confronted by challenges, when we're girded by such knowledge, we can overcome. And that risk means shut out of our Father's home. Knowledge is empowering. And the only thing that is more enabling still is understanding, which is derived by making reasoned connections between those things that we come to know. Knowledge is always good so long as we are discerning. That's why I'm a huge advocate for free speech. I thought that the thought police that were previously imposed on Facebook but have now been released from it by Mark Zuckerberg, and the restrictions on free speech that used to be on X but no longer exist are hugely important. People ought to be able to make a fool of themselves. They ought to be able to say whatever they want to say. And we individually ought to be disciplined in our discernment so that we can differentiate between truth and lies, right and wrong, good and bad. When somebody celebrates in the streets and in universities, as Muslims and progressives are doing, celebrating what occurred in Israel when Muslims raped and tortured and abducted and committed acts of mass murder, you know that something, or should know that something, is seriously wrong with their noggin. Something is seriously wrong with their sense of morality. You ought to be able to say stupid stuff, but you ought to be able to differentiate, which the religious don't seem to be able to do, nor do the overtly political. So we have to be discriminating. And the best way of knowing what is good and bad, productive and counterproductive, as it relates to, was to study the Torah. But if pursuing the Christian New Testament, the rabbinical Talmud, or the Islamic Quran, the person who isn't discriminating will ingest debilitating toxins. Nevertheless, since evil proliferates when unchallenged and unchecked, on occasion it is incumbent of some of us to rebuke man's most deadly venoms. And that can only be done through the knowledge of good and evil. In light of God's previous point that we can be tainted by what we eat, should our quest for knowledge take us away from the light, from that which is correct, beneficial, and good, and toward the darkness of that which is improper and counterproductive? Unless it is to warn God's people about the horrid consequences associated with, for example, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, those who expose themselves are likely poisoning their souls and will die. Excuse me. In a very real sense, it is the tree of becoming aware. Watermelon juice there is the odd color of that, something my wife brewed up for me for a scratchy throat. I apologize. But I think it is the tree of becoming aware, something that I've tried to devote myself to these past 23 years. And by contrast, at least at this point, all Adam knew was Yahweh, the benefits of the relationship, the beauty of the environment. But by failing to properly examine and consider God's instructions, he would soon encounter the great deceiver and experience what it's like to be separated from God. Said another way, the acquisition of Da'at knowledge is good or bad based upon the credibility of the source, its reliability, and the intent. When directed at Yahweh's testimony with Da'at, we can accumulate information and observe instructions which enable rational thought and the exercise of good judgment. By making responsible and reasonable connections along the way, we come to understand and benefit from the relationship that God has intended for us. And by warning the innocent about Ra, that which is vile and wrong, our knowledge of it can protect them. Excuse me. This second tree, therefore, is a referendum between that which is moral and right, valuable and worthy, even generous, pleasing, and joyful, against that which is immoral and wrong, worthless and restrictive, displeasing and harmful. When it pertains to Yah, it is relationship versus religion. That is the ultimate choice. And through these contrasts of light and darkness, Yahweh was offering Adam and us through him a choice. Which of these do you prefer? And are you willing to listen to God and rely upon his provisions or take the advice of others, not knowing if they are reliable, if they're telling the truth, or the ultimate consequence of it? You know, for example, Paul claimed to speak for God. He wrote and inspired most of the Christian New Testament. You know, his 14 letters came first, and then he shaped the Gospels in his image. And if you believe that he spoke for God, then, well, you have been misled, because all he did was contradict God. And if you're contradicting God, you can't be speaking for him. It is exceedingly simple to think your way out of Christianity. But you have to know what God said, and then you have to think. And that is the issue we're discussing. Sometimes it is little things which make the biggest difference. In the previous statement in Genesis 2:16, a call was repeated, a call, intensifying the action defined by the infinitive call imperfect, rendering a call, you may genuinely devour and consume consistently and enthusiastically, being fed and nurtured, continually being defined by actually eating. But when negated at the conclusion of Bereshith 2:17, the verb stands alone and without the imperfect conjugation. Therefore, it conveys the idea that he would be defined by having eaten from it, actually describing himself by what he consumed. The opportunities would be endless compared to the loan restriction. God presented this as a cause and consequence. It therefore was constructive advice, not a command. A general only provides soldiers with the consequence of disobeying his orders when he knows that a command will not withstand scrutiny. Do this or else. But in this decision to become aware of right and wrong and to understand the difference between good and bad, it was revealed that each person determines their fate by their individual choices. There has been much written about Ba-yum, Muth-muth, because Adam did not die in the day that he discounted Yahweh's instructions. And the reason for this is as direct as it is profound. What ended the day they twisted God's instructions to suit their agendas was Adam's and Chawa's ability to live with Yahweh. Therefore, God's message to us is that if we jeopardize our opportunity to be with him in the garden, the land, or in heaven, as a direct consequence of ignoring or rejecting, errantly stating or misconstruing his guidance here on earth, that we will endure the same fate. Well, we're getting a little ahead of God's story. The inherent teaching is that the disposition of Adam's and Chawa's souls and those of their descendants would be at their discretion. They would soon be subject to the influence of other men and women, and their interactions and affiliations with them and apart from God would determine the length of their lives and the ultimate result. The bad decisions which would banish them on this fateful day of their rebellion could only be resolved by making good ones with respect to Yahweh on another, more rational time. The reason that we were told that Adam lived a total of 930 years, likely some 50 in the garden and some 870-odd with other humans, was to define the length of a day in the context of being with God or man. Adam's death in year 874-ish, which is 3094 BCE, was within the pronounced first day apart from the garden. The millennial marker of year 1000 would occur 124 years later in 2968 BCE and be commemorated with Noah's birth, beginning the 10th generation, if you will, of man at that time. And with Noah, we witness the desired result. He listened to Yahweh and he acted responsibly, doing as God instructed, and his life was spared in an adventure which came to symbolize the covenant aboard the ark. Now, having begun in Eden, there would be six eras of human toil outside of the garden, followed by a seventh millennia upon our return to it. Each 1,000 years in duration, Adam would die during the first day as a result of, well, neglecting God's guidance. And Noah would live at the beginning of a new day, showing us the way back home. Considering all of this, I think that there are three issues at play. First, for there to be love, there must be the choice, lots of choice, and there must be one choice not to love. And so there must be the opportunity to reject the relationship, the existence of this tree of good and bad. Provided Adam and also Chawa and thus humankind with this choice, building the ark to God's specifications provided evidence of the other approach. Second, Adam knew Yahweh. He was perfect. Their relationship was entertaining and enlightening. He had direct and unencumbered access to his father. There were no competing voices or alternative schemes. Therefore, since everything he experienced was tov good for him and for Chawa, the only thing which changed as a result of eating the fruit was experiencing raw bad. It was harmful and counterproductive, even deadly. Third, in Yahweh's presence, there would have been no benefit to knowing what was not trustworthy. Adam and Chawa did not need to differentiate between religion and relationship, the paths away from God and the way home, because he was already living in God's home with him in an idyllic garden full of life and love. Therefore, for the first man and woman created in God's image, there was nothing that the tree of the knowledge of good and bad could add which would enhance their experience. Exposure to it was exclusively bad from their perspective, which is why Yahweh advised against it. That, however, is not necessarily true today, because we have to know what is wrong to be properly motivated to disassociate from it. It is why God asked me to transition from translating and thinking and learning, deducing insights, writing commentary, and sharing what I had learned in 35 books over the last 23 years, to coming into your home and speaking to you. And in that process, it is essential that I help you understand how you and your culture, your community, your people have been deceived, so that you're able to then ingest what is good and divest what is bad. The lesson for us is that when we return to the Garden of Eden upon Yahweh's homecoming, after the elimination of all that is raw and the restoration of that which is tov here on earth, we will be in the same position as were Adam and Chawa. And that means that the Torah instructions Yahweh will be offering his children at that time will be good and beneficial. This is why I have, from many, many years ago, when the covenant is reaffirmed in Yirmiyah 31, what I specifically say, and that, by the way, was my beloved Labrador Asher, the little whiny, I shouldn't say whiny, the less vocal yap previously was by Asher's pal, Wookie. These are live streams, and so there is no opportunity to edit life out. But I think that's what makes them credible. To sit down, look you in the eye, speak directly to you without interruption, well, with exception of a woof here and there, I think is a lot more credible. You can tell from the expression on my face, from the tone of my voice, and from the way that I am sharing this message with you, that I know it, that I understand it, and that God Himself has convinced me that it is my responsibility to share it with you. And that's why we're doing these programs. So many years ago, I came to recognize that in Jeremiah 31, when Yahweh says, I'm going to reaffirm his covenant relationship with his people. He specifically says he's going to reaffirm it with Yisrael and Yehudim, which means he's not creating a new covenant with Gentiles to create a church. So they got that entirely wrong. But when he says, I'm going to reestablish my covenant relationship, and it's not going to be exactly like the covenant, not with Abraham, but with the children of Israel, when Yahweh, with a strong and firm, uncompromising hand, led them out of enslavement in Mitzrayim. And the reason it wouldn't be exactly the same as that, Israelites in Mitzrayim in Egypt didn't know God. They had no idea who he was. They had no concept of what he was offering or what he was expecting in return. And all they had known their whole lives was slavery. And therefore, freedom was even scary to them. And so rather than say, okay, who wants to go on a great adventure, taking votes now? I didn't do that. That'd have been stupid. God's not stupid. He said, I grabbed them with a firm hand, and I dragged them kicking and screaming all across the Sinai Peninsula, across the Gulf of Aqaba, and into Arabia, where, you know, they remained irascible, but it was in their interest. And sometimes a father has to be firm with his children. When Yahweh reaffirms his covenant relationship with his people, he says, it's not going to be like that. You're going to have to choose it. It'll be only by your own free will. God is not going to bring Israelites back into the covenant relationship after 3,000 plus years of them being on the wrong side, looking in, kicking and screaming. You will come of your own free will or not at all. And so then Yahweh says, and this is the point of this diversion into that text, that those who join him in this renewal of the covenant, reaffirmation of the covenant, he's going to personally write inside of us a copy of his Torah. And this copy of his Torah is to help guide us throughout eternity and into dimensions beyond the three we experience here on earth. And I've always said those Torah instructions need to be a lowercase t. Now, there's no such thing as an upper or lowercase letter in Hebrew. They're all the same case. But the idea still is with us in English, that Torah capital T is the title of the first five books that comprise Yahweh's message to us, beginning with Bereshith and concluding with Devarim. And Torah lowercase would be God's instructions and directions, guidance and teaching, which is what Torah means. And so my conclusion is that when he writes his Torah inside of us, it's going to be Torah lowercase t, because 99% of what's in the existing Torah isn't going to help us in eternity. And all of the things that the Israelites did that were horrible, they were really bad on the Exodus. They're going to make us sad. They'd make us miserable. We'd be anguished over what we did to God. And so there's no reason for him to repeat those. We're back in the garden, if you will. So his instructions to us at that time will be how to get the most out of being a seven-dimensional being, and how we can explore the universe, explore the nature of life, enjoy working alongside of our God and our other brothers and sisters in the covenant. Enjoy learning, but with God's instruction, so we capitalize on this opportunity in a responsible way. That number of choices that are afforded to us, just as we go from 3.5 dimensions stuck in time as we are now, to fully integrated into the fourth dimension, is an infinite increase. And it's an infinite increase again as we go through the fifth, sixth, and seventh dimensions. So we're going to need some guidance so that we capitalize on our opportunity and don't do things that will endanger us or others. So it's going to be a lowercase t. And that means that the Torah instructions should be considered guidance and teaching, all of which will be beneficial. In his productive care, there will be an infinite number of beneficial opportunities along with a minimal number of instructions to keep his children safe. But even between now and then, we actually need what the first couple consumed. Knowledge. We have to have knowledge of good and bad such that we can rationally discern the difference between them and choose the path to leave and choose the path to follow so that we leave the corruption of human religion and politics and militarism, conspiracy, and we choose to follow the path that Yahweh has provided home. Now, this is the first time the consequence for rejecting Yahweh's instructions has been specified. And you'll notice it isn't eternal damnation. The consequence for ignoring God's instructions is simply death. Eternal damnation and death are very different things. Something that I came to realize, I may be the first person to ever realize, that Yahweh is not saying if you disregard him, that he's going to torment your soul forever in hell. If he did, he'd be sadistic. If he did, there really would be no choice. If he did, he'd make everything associated with him fearsome and disgusting. That's why so many atheists say that, you know, this notion that God says, love me or I'm going to torture you forever in hell, is absurd, and they choose not to be religious. Well, God never said such a thing. And here's the first evidence of it. He says the consequence of disregarding him isn't torture. He's not playing Allah, you know. He's not saying that it's going to be fires and, you know, like the Christian Jesus. They're going to scald people. In fact, there are not going to even be any bodies after our departure. Our bodies rot away. It's only our souls. And so he's saying that the soul is going to die. The soul dissipates into nothingness. There's no reward. There is no punishment for those who choose to neglect Yahweh's instructions. That is an essential truth. And the realization that there are therefore three options for human souls. You can choose to follow Yahweh's instructions and go to Shamaim. You can choose to ignore them and your soul simply ceases to exist. You can choose to lead people away from God and harm his people, as so many are doing today, and you get to have an all full paid trip to Sheol, where you'll get to spend an eternity as Hasatan's guest. No fires, it's a black hole. No light, only one dimension. Time is eternal. Don't take that choice. This is the very thought that God is conveying to you, and I likely the first person in human history to present these three destinations to you so that you could understand what your options are, and that so you would appreciate the fact that God is being incredibly fair when he says that if you disregard him, the consequence is simply death. You were given the gift of life. You were given the gift of free will. You were given the capacity to think through your Nesama, conscience, hey, just squander them. So no harm, no foul. You got your life. It was all a gift and beneficial for you. You didn't take advantage of it. And at the end of life, that's just the end of life. And that means that the result of disregarding Yah's instructions is not eternal suffering. Yet every mainstream Christian derivation, Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, and evangelical, insist that those who reject their God are damned to an eternity in hell. Their God is a liar because Yahweh just said the opposite. Moreover, the Christian God is sadistic, as is Allah in the Quran, who spends all of his time, by the way, torturing people in hell throughout the Quran. Only a demented deity would say, obey me, or I'll torture you forever. Not only is the Hebrew word for death repeated twice in this passage, muth is the antithesis of eternal existence in hell. Therefore, for the church or mosque to be right, God must be wrong. It's that simple, that obvious, that cut and dry. And yet, not one religious cleric in a million comprehends this divine mandate. It is as if their fear of that they engender by errantly presenting their religious hell serves their interest by frightening the faithful into compliance and contributions. Or else, why would they all promote the same lie? I mean, it's the got to be in the top three or four most repeated themes throughout the Quran. You don't capitulate to Allah and become his slave and fight and kill for him, then he will personally assure that you spend all eternity in his company being tortured. Ridiculous. I'm not sure Christianity is much better. In the case of Judaism, they simply deny the existence of heaven and hell. Maybe slightly better, but it's not right. As we make our way through the Torah teachings and Nabi prophet statements and the books bearing now Yahweh's brand, we find overwhelming evidence that Yahweh lists three consequences related to the choices that we make, as I have just stated, not two. Therefore, we must have three potential fates which await us depending on our choices. The most often presented, the most common is this one, death, the cessation of life. Those who choose not to yada Yahweh, who do not trust and rely upon him, will live for a very short while. But ultimately, death will be the end of their existence. Upon their mortal demise, their souls will cease to exist. God doesn't know them. They don't know God. For the overwhelming preponderance of people, there will be no eternal life in the Father's home, nor hell by any definition. This insight is profoundly important, and yet it was unknown prior to being heralded by me in these pages. The two better known consequences, well, they still exist. There is a place of eternal separation, complete exile from the garden. However, there is no fire in it. There is no torture because Sheol is a lightless prison, estranged from God. The closest known allegory to this would be a black hole where nothing escapes. Time remains eternal. Only those who are actively engaged in leading people away from God, which would be most religious and political authorities, many media spokesmen, lots of academics and societal influencers, and those who deliberately harm God's people, like all of the Muslims that are calling for this extermination of Israel and Jews, as well as the progressives that are aiding and abetting them, those who participated in or celebrated the torture of Jews on 10/7/23. So if you are sent to Sheol as a result of doing either of these two things, you will, well, be in a very popular and religious place because every pope is going to be there. It will be exceedingly religious. You'll find Paul there. You'll find Akiba. You'll find Muhammad. We'll all be there. So if you emulate them, if you venerate them, you'll get to spend your eternity with them. Special bonus. God's fair, after all. The consequence of listening to Yahweh's instructions and accepting his advice is to live forever with him in his home, whether that is in Eden, as was the case with Adam, as will be the case with all of us that are part of the covenant family, Yisrael, or heaven thereafter. Those who rely on Yah become covenant, become his children, and they inherit all that is his to give. After serving with him during, the millennial Shabbat, starting on the Mikra of Sukkah in 2033, which is year 6000 Yah. If that's confusing to you and you are Jewish and you think that we are hundreds of years from that time, then Well, you've been duped by another religious fraud. Mohammedes was an absolute raving lunatic who was hugely influenced by Islam and their fascination with the number 19 and the moon. And in his sanctification of the moon chapter, he wrote a script based upon the number 19 and conceived a calendar that had absolutely nothing to do with the Torah. So you've been duped. It is now less than 8 years. 8 years and 8 months, actually, to Yahweh's return in October of 2033. Well, 1,000 years thereafter, the immortal remnant of Yisrael is going to be able to camp out with God and the conditions of the earth restored to as they have been presented here in Eden. And everyone will be equipped to camp out with God at that time. If you make this choice, you know, look me up. We'll go off and we'll explore a galaxy together. It'll be fun. As we press on and dig deeper into the story of Eden, we discover that Yahweh's testimony is focused on developing a relationship with his creation. This engaged and loving association is set into the context of family, of companionship, of sharing, and ultimately of marriage and children and parenting. This essential phase of God's presentation begins with the following words, and I'm going to share them with you, and then we'll rejoin here in the fifth edition of In the Garden, just because it's not fair of me to speak as long as I would like to. If you wind me up, I could probably go on for 12 hours, and I don't think that would be fair. So I will leave you with these words. Yahweh Almighty said, "It is not good for the man Adam to exist alone by himself." This is one of the most profound statements ever written. It shows that the God who created us knew our nature, that we were conceived to be a being that enjoyed relationships, a being that would not want to be ostracized, abandoned, left alone. We thrive on companionship and on community. And Yahweh recognized it wasn't good for man to be alone in the garden. God also recognized something even more profound than that, which is that if Yahweh is the only source of engagement, of conversation, of entertainment for Adam, then he has no choice at all. Because to be deprived of contact, Adam would go crazy, just like a person who is locked in a cell in solitary confinement. After a while, insanity sets in. And so God knew that if he was the only option, as wonderful as Yahweh is for Adam, and he had no other option in terms of socialization, that it wasn't good for him. It wasn't good for the relationship. It's important that we have the option at all times to choose to be with one another or not. Boy, have I ever experienced that recently. You need to have that option, but you need to understand what the consequences are of your choices. And in this case, Yahweh thought that the best possible circumstance for Adam was to not be alone. And he also knew that by establishing that kind of a scenario, that rather than just having a captive relationship with one person, God was opening the door to engaging in a mutually beneficial relationship with all of us, making the family wonderful, expanding the possibilities, enriching heaven by having more people, a larger family, others to go off with and explore the universe and the nature of life. And so that is what Yahweh was trying to achieve with these words. Well, this is the conclusion of part 4 of our expose of In the Garden. This has been the Iowa Blog, and I am your host, Craig Wynn.